twixt between two. One of you has said, you've got 45 minutes. And that gets me out here at 7:59. And Jason said, well, we're having a meeting afterwards. If you finish early, we'd appreciate it. I know. What do I do? All right. there's a clock staring at me, so hopefully life will be merciful to you all. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 42. What I would like to do this evening is to look at the servant songs in a general way, and then, as time allows, talk a little bit more about the most famous of them all, which is Isaiah 53. But the background here of this book and Isaiah 40 is an interesting background. Isaiah lived in his lifetime. He was a prophet to the southern kingdom, Judah, but he lived to see the northern kingdom destroyed, Samaria overrun, and the people of the northern kingdom taken captive by Assyria. He also witnessed the miraculous deliverance of Hezekiah and of Jerusalem, and he wrote the first part of the book, and right at the end of chapter the first section, 36 through 39, gives us a little history of the end of that miraculous deliverance. But starting at chapter 40, and I take it, as most evangelical and conservative folks, that Isaiah wrote this section, and that this section, even though it's very different from the first, is written by Isaiah, and it has a meaning and a message of salvation. What has happened is that Israel, that's the northern 10 tribes, were destroyed because of sin, idolatry, and they had turned completely away from God. The southern kingdom was a mite better, but not a lot. And the message that Isaiah has for them is that if you sin and you continue in sin, then you are going to be destroyed too, and yet there is going to come a salvation. Now, this goes back to the covenant that God had made with David. And you remember that covenant where he said that there will never depart a son of yours from the throne. And he said, even though one of them sins, you know, he'll be disciplined, the nation will be taken away, but I will not utterly withdraw my covenant from David. And this is in fulfillment of that. Now, what's so important here is that this gives to us wonderful prophecies intermixed with words of destruction and doom for Judah and Jerusalem, but it gives us wonderful prophecies of salvation for those Jewish people. And you'll see that it comes not just limited to the Jews, but also to the Israelites. So you can start this, and what I like to do is to think of this section of Isaiah, chapter 40 and on, as a kind of symphony. Now, if I would hum to you just four notes, you would know exactly what I'm trying to say, wouldn't you? Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Do you know what that is? Well, it's Beethoven's Fifth, isn't it? But what happens in Beethoven's Fifth, if you know the rest of it, you know, it's developed, that theme, just four notes, that theme is developed throughout the symphony. Not only that theme, but other themes as well. They're interwoven, and it comes together in a finale, you know, four movements later. Well, I like to think of this as a symphony. This symphony is got parts of it, and it moves from one idea to the next, and the ideas are developed. Now, we're going to see the idea developed of the servant. Well, and we'll see who the servant is. But the servant is a person, but it's not the only time the Hebrew word servant is used. It's used of Israel, the servant. It's also used of a coming king called Cyrus. But there are contexts where it cannot be Israel, and I'll show them to you. And there, so the servant must be an individual in some context. And like everything in Scripture, context rules. It's the context that determines the meaning and which servant they're talking about. There are times when Israel is referred to as the servant, but there are times when it cannot be Israel. It must be an individual, and we know from the New Testament days that that individual is Jesus Christ. Now, let's just read part of these servant songs. There are four of them. If I asked you, could you tell me what four chapters have these four servant songs? Oh, that's very good, Jason. You got one out of four. What are you turned to right now? Ha! That's two out of four. Oh, there's two others, and you think about them. But these form a unit developing an idea. And that idea is that this servant is going to come, a servant of the Lord, one who does the Lord's bidding, and he's going to do some things. Let's read the first four verses of Isaiah 42. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delighteth. Who's speaking? Yahweh, isn't he? The Lord, Yahweh, or Jehovah. I prefer Yahweh because that's the four letters. You know, Jehovah is a hybrid word that never occurs. And that's a different subject, totally different. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry, nor lift up his voice, nor cause it to be heard in the street. A bruised reed will he not break, in a dimly burning wick will he not quench. He will bring forth justice in truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he have set justice in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. Now, what's the thing, the primary thing, that the servant is going to do? He's mentioned three times. He's going to bring justice. Justice. Justice is what we all look for, isn't it? Justice. What does it mean, though, here in this particular word that is used? Mishpat is the word. Let me illustrate it in a farming illustration in Isaiah chapter 28. I especially like farming illustrations because I married into a farm family and farmed for a number of years. I'm still doing it part-time, interestingly enough. Now, in Isaiah 28, we have a very homey kind of an illustration, a farming illustration, and we start at verse 23. It says, give ye ear and hear my voice, hearken and hear my speech. Doth he that plow to sow plow continually? In other words, if you're plowing to sow a crop, do you plow all the time and never sow your crop? Well, no, of course not. It's foolishness. And he says, doth he continually open and harrow his ground? And the answer is obvious, no. When he hath leveled the face thereof, doth he not cast abroad the fitches and scatter the cumin and put in the wheat and rows and barley in their appointed place and the spelt in the border thereof? For God doth instruct him aright. And that word aright there is the word mishpat, interestingly enough. Think of it, God doth instruct him with justice and doth teach him. Now, this is a very common, you think in today's terms, does a man go out, a farmer go out and plow his ground and then plow it again and keep plowing it? No. He plows it and then he'll disc it And then he'll run the culturature over it. And then he'll plant. And in 3 or 4 months, he will get a crop. Now, that's a logical order of things. And that's what this particular word basically means, at its root level, a right ordering of things. And he says God has put it in, you know, the farmer, he's put it in his right, in his mind, with justice, with a right ordering of things. There's a certain order, and that order, when it's obeyed and when it's done, produces a crop. Now, what the servant is going to do, he's going to come, turn back to chapter 42, he's going to come, and the Spirit, my Spirit, Yahweh says, is going to be upon him, and he'll bring forth justice to whom? Not just to Israel or Judah here in this context, to the nation of Israel that remains, who's going to be in exile, who's going to be in exile because of their sin, but is going to be brought back into the land. There's going to be a right ordering of things. Those who have been oppressed will be comforted and will be, their wrongs will be righted. Those who have done wrong will be disciplined or judged for it. And there's going to be a right ordering of things. Now, how many of you think there's a right ordering of things in the world today? Well, it doesn't take much to look around and see that there is not a right ordering of things. To use our friends south of the border, is it right that 4% of the population in Mexico controls 96% of the wealth? Is that right? No, it's not right. No, I'm not preaching for, demonstrating in the streets and overthrowing the government. I'm just saying that it's not right. It's not just. There's not a right ordering of things. But when the Messiah comes, he's going to bring a right order to things, to his universe, to the world in which we live. And that's what we call the millennium, isn't it? Of course. Now, notice that it's not just going to be to Israel. The Messiah, he's not called the Messiah. In fact, the only time in the book of Isaiah where the Messiah is used, he's used as, it literally means the anointed one, is used of Cyrus. But this servant, as we go down the road of prophecy, we find is indeed the anointed one, the Messiah, to come and bring a right order to things. And certainly, Cyrus did not do that. So here we have the first, the smallest, and it gives us a nugget. You know, what is the Messiah going to do? Now, the second servant song of the four is going to develop the theme. Turn to chapter 49. And in chapter 49, we read a few words where it says let's read verse 5. And now saith the Lord that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him, and that Israel be gathered again unto him. For I am honorable in the eyes of the Lord, or Yahweh, and my God has become my strength. Yea, he saith it. It is too light a thing that he should be a servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to restore the preserved of Israel. He will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou may beest my salvation unto the end of the earth. And you see the development here, don't you? What? It's not just to Jacob, but he's a light to the Gentiles. And it says, keep going, thus saith the Lord, verse 7, the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to him whom man despiseth, to him whom the nations abhorreth, to a servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise, princes, and they shall worship, because of Yahweh that is faithful, even the Holy One of Israel who hath chosen thee. Notice, there's a hint here in the second servant song that there's going to be some trouble, isn't there? He says, to him whom man despiseth, to him whom nations abhor. And so there's a hint here, very small, but a hint of his humiliation to come. And as we see that's going to be developed again. Now let's turn to chapter 50. which is the third of the servant songs. And we read here, starting at verse 4. The Lord Yahweh hath given me the tongue of them that are taught, that I may know how to sustain with words him that is weary. He wakeneth morning by morning. He wakeneth mine ear to hear as they that are taught. And we won't take the time to look at it, but this is referred to in John chapter 8, where Jesus refers to the Father as teaching him, gave him the tongue of the learned, one who was taught. He wakeneth mine ear to hear as they that are taught. Verse 5, and the Lord hath opened mine ear, and I was not rebellious, neither turned away backward. I gave my back to the smiters, and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. For the Lord Yahweh will help me. Therefore have I not been confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint. I know that I shall not be put to shame. He is near that justifieth me. Who will contend with me? Let us stand together. Who is mine adversary? Let him come near to me. Behold, the Lord Yahweh will help me. Who is he that will condemn me? Behold, they all shall wax old as a garment, and the moth shall eat them up. Who is among you that feareth the Lord, that obeyeth the voice of his servant? And here's the reference to the servant right here. He that walketh in darkness and hath no light, let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. And here we have a little bit more development, like that symphony where themes are developed and added to. Here the idea of humiliation, of suffering, is a little more, isn't it? And these are familiar words, aren't they? But they fit in the context here in Isaiah, where he's started small. Generally, this Messiah, this servant, is going to bring a right ordering of things, justice to the nations, and he's going to bring light to the Gentiles, but he's going to suffer. And we see here that he gave his face. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. The Lord will help me. Verse 6, I gave my back to the smiters, my cheek to them that plucked off the hair. And so we see his suffering again. Now, let's turn to chapter 53, which we all know, thankfully. It's a very important one. And I would like to suggest that this is important for a number of reasons. The first one that I'm just going to say, not in any particular order, is that you have a culmination here in these servant songs. There's four of them, and this is the fourth. It starts with the theme of suffering, which is prevalent here. In fact, it's throughout this song. This is the song that deals predominantly with that suffering, that vicarious suffering of the servant for his people. But the theme is developed, and here it comes to a climax. And because of that, I would suggest that this is the most important. Not only that, this song, if you will, a hymn, is in the very apex of the second section of Isaiah. And if you just look at it generally, it comes and this is the very middle, and it's at the apex of this particular book. And so it is important for a number of reasons. And probably the most important is this is referred to by the writers of the New Testament over and over again, referred to as being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Now, even if I didn't know that, I would suggest to you that it's so clear. In fact, in the Targums, they refer to the Targums. Do you know the Targums? These are the Jewish scriptures amplified. We have the Amplified New Testament. The Targums are kind of an amplification and translation plus commentary all involved in one. And they refer to this servant as the Messiah. And it wasn't until much later where, the Jewish rabbis started to interpret this servant as being the nation. Well, the word can refer to the nation in the 40, chapters 40 through 66 of Isaiah. It can do that. But here I'm going to show you from this chapter, and I could have from the last two, that it cannot, in some context at least, refer to the nation as a group. So let's look at the whole, and we're going to see, just as in the four servant songs you have, this is the climax, you're going to see here just by the amount of words in the space that there are five strophes or stanzas to this hymn. I'll call them strophes because that's more poetic, perhaps. And the first is the shortest, and the last is the longest. And it kind of builds to a climax, and you can see it just in the form. So let's think about now, the chapter divisions were not biblical. They simply were not. And sometimes the folks who backed Usher in his day, who put the chapter divisions in, and didn't do a very good job. For whatever reason, and you'll find this isn't the only one. There's a bunch where it's just not ideal where the chapter division is. But in your mind, remember, there's no chapter divisions in the original text. And you can see that, you know, when you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, who have the whole book of Isaiah, interestingly enough, in those Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered back in 1947, 48, something like that. All right, so the servant song actually begins in chapter 32, verse 13, and you can see it where it says, like in chapter 42, "Behold my servant." Now let's look briefly and just make selective comments about this particular servant. We're going to look briefly at each one of these strophes and try to understand what is being said. In the first strophe, it's basically a summarization of what this servant is going to do, and it wraps it all up in a few short words. Notice what he says, "Behold, my servant shall deal wisely." And then it says, "He shall be exalted and lifted up and shall be very high." Now, what you have here, it could be, "He shall be raised up," or "he shall be raised up and lifted up and be very high." There's three stages here, and I want to just suggest to you, and I don't have any reason to back it up other than it's highly suggestive, that what you have here is a prophecy of our Savior who was raised up on the cross, who was then ascended to heaven at the ascension, and who now is very high, exalted at the right hand of the Father, and who makes intercession for us. Now, I suggest that to you. I don't want to, go to, the chair for that. I don't want to do that. But it's suggestive when it talks about he'll be raised up, if you look at the original word. And I do want to point together the unity here of this section. If that's the case, and shall be very high, what is the last thing that is said in this song in verse 12 of chapter 53? The last thing is said, it says, "and he makes," or it could be legitimate, "will make intercession for the transgressors." Well, where does Jesus make intercession for the transgressors? At the cross, or at the right hand of the Father, who makes intercession. Now, transgressors here are forgiven transgressors, aren't they? They're the ones who put them to death. Actually, you and I put them to death vicariously. But as we go through, let's look at what is said. "He shall be exalted, he shall be very high." And then it says, "like as many were astonished at thee," and then it's kind of a parenthesis, "his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." And it says, "so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them, they shall see. And that which they had not heard, they shall understand." What is it that they had not heard? Well, they hadn't heard, these particular kings heard, that the servant was the Messiah who had died and who is now exalted and very high, you know, who now intercedes for us. And, you know, he's going to say that there's astonishment here. There's surprise. They didn't understand. And that goes into the next strophe, which starts, I believe, verse 1, although a number of commentators quibble. You know, some say that the first strophe ends at the end of the first section of the first phrase of verse 15. So shall he sprinkle many nations. And then the next section starts where it says, kings shall shut their mouths at him. I'll let you decide for yourself which is more appropriate, because there are no verse markings as well as chapter markings in the original text, and we know that. Then it says, who hath believed our report, is the King James, or who hath believed what we had heard? In other words, the perspective here is the perspective, I believe, of a person living at the time of the Messiah, of the time of the servant, of the time of Jesus, and did not understand, did not comprehend what was happening, what was going down. They didn't understand what the servant was supposed to do, what he did do, and then the accomplishment of that servant, which we know is our salvation. They didn't understand, and that's the idea. Who hath believed what we have heard? And to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? And then it talks about his beginnings. He grew up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. In other words, he was nothing special to look at. Now, you have to know that he was a strong man. Uncle Dave said, leave the sports out of it. But if you go into the... He's right, I should do that. If you go into the temple and you throw the money changers out, you have to be a fairly strong and athletic kind of a guy, don't you? You have to be able to do those things and to do them without fear of being tossed out yourself. You can't be a little Johnny Milktoast or a little wimp of a man to do that. But what he's saying is that he was a normal man. To look at him, you would not think that here is the Son of God. You would not look at him and think, here's one, when he dies, he's dying for me. That they didn't understand that. And they thought, there's nothing that we should look at him and that we should think, this is an important man. It wasn't that case. In fact, it says he just was, you know, as a tender plant. He grew up as, you know how tender plants, I have some plants in my garden right now. Some of them are very tender. And some of them droop, you know, when the sun comes out. Some of them just are not healthy. You know, they're not vigorous and they just grow strong and everything works right. And I think that's it. A root out of a dry ground, you don't see a healthy, strong, vigorous plant out of ground that's dry. You know, a plant needs moisture. And we all know that, don't we? And that's the imagery that we have here. Let's continue on. Since there was no beauty that we should desire him. And then verse 3, he was despised and rejected. By the way, how many of you ever go regularly to hear Messiah by Handel? This is beautiful stuff. And I kind of makes you want to break out into song. Here, the alto sings this, and it's just gorgeous. Some of the things that interest me, I sing in it with my daughters, and we do a production at Bedford every year. And the interesting thing is that you have some people who are singing the solos who are not believers, you know, but they're singing, you know, and they're singing these words that are just absolutely wonderful words. And this is a wonderful solo for an aria for an alto here. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And I believe the translation, and most of them today now have it something like this. And as one from whom men hide their face. In other words, if you look at something gruesome, that is ugly, that is torturous, that is violent, we tend to hide our face. We don't want to look. And that's the idea here. Is one from whom men hide their faces. And it was not a pretty sight, him hanging on the cross. It simply was not. But it says he was despised, and we esteemed him not. And then it talks about the, you know, the third strophe, which says, you know, talks about his substitutionary death. Now notice here, you have he and we. You have third person and first person four times, and if you don't think that there is the vicarious atonement here, or the vicarious sacrifice, we call it the penal substitutionary sacrifice for our sins. In this chapter alone, in this hymn, there are about 10. There's at least 9 and 10, is if I can count, you know, if I count them all. But here's what we have, and look at them. Surely he hath borne our griefs, he hath borne our griefs, and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. And you have here the vicarious nature of the sacrifice that Jesus performed for us. Unbelievable. There's many hymns that come from this, and we could just stop right here and meditate and think about that. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement, and I believe it probably is better here, for our peace. The chastisement which brought us our peace, you know, was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. And then verse 6, you know, looks at all of us, not all Jews, not all Gentiles, all men without exception. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. And there it is, that vicarious substitutionary atonement. Let's continue. We don't have time to stay, and I apologize for that. Now, as these strophes get longer, they get a little more more material about the prophetic nature of this prophecy, that what is going to happen. And it talks in then verse 7 through 9 about his death, about his crucifixion. And let's look at that for a minute. And basically what he's saying is that this man died and suffered without being violent, without rebelling, without reviling. He was silent. Now, one of the things you can say about the Jewish nation, and I remember I mentioned that first early, and that is that if this refers to the Jewish nation has certainly suffered as a nation down through the centuries. There's no doubt. There's no doubt at all. You know, you go through the Inquisition, the auto da fes, the pogroms, the Holocaust. The Jews as a nation have suffered greatly. But one thing you cannot say is that they suffered silently. You know, they have never been silent. Now, whether others have listened, that's quite another thing. But notice what it says. We'll continue on, and you'll see what has happened. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is dumb, he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And I think what he's saying here is that this was unjust. There was no reason, no just reason for his crucifixion. Now, you know, it was all done in the middle of the night. It was a lynch job. But the Jews had a point, did they not? What did they try him for? Blasphemy, didn't they? Blasphemy. They said that he made himself equal with God. Well, he did. And so they were right if Jesus was not God. But they decided to ignore all of his works, ignore everything that he did, ignore all of the evidence that he was who he said he was, and they said, "You're blaspheming. You know, we're going to crucify you." Now, they were right if he was wrong, but he was wrong, he was right, and they were wrong. But he silently took it. Notice, but and he's talking about here about his trial. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away, and as for his generation, Who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due? Now that's a long sentence that can be translated in various ways, and I would just suggest that you look at it. But what he's saying is that nobody, you know, it says, as for his generation, you know, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? In evidence, what happened is he died a very young man without a family, and most of the time, well, you see it in the attitude of the two on the road to Emmaus. You remember what they said? We had hoped that he was one who would bring salvation to Israel. You know, they thought he was the Messiah, and they were totally depressed. They were disappointed. They were despondent because they felt, because he died as a young man and he had no progeny, that it was over. That was it for him. Well, notice what it says. Now, verse 9 I do want to spend a little bit of time on, because this is one of those, what we call, at least what some commentators call, an inorganic prophecy. Now, what is meant by an inorganic prophecy is the opposite of an organic prophecy. And so, an organic prophecy is a prophecy like in the beginning of chapter 7 and most of Isaiah 53, which talks about the servant suffering for his people, being put to death, and you know, in Isaiah 50, chapter 50, you know, you have the same thing. In Isaiah 49, you have the same thing, where this prophecy is specific, but it's general enough to be applied to different ones. But it's a prophecy of what's going to happen. Now, here is a prophecy of what's going to happen, but it has nothing to do with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. If there were no verse 9... then it would do nothing to the penal substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ. It would do nothing to the fact of the resurrection. Although it would be more difficult to justify the resurrection, we're going to see from verse 9. But it's one of those incidental things that gives proof, that gives evidence to the prophecies that point to Jesus Christ. Now let's see what it says. And I want you to notice, it says, they made his grave with the wicked. Now, I think the authorized version says, he made his grave with the wicked. Is that correct? Any of you have the author? He made his grave with the wicked. Well, the idea of made here is not quite correct. Jesus, unless you say, well, he's sovereign over all the affairs and therefore he made his... No. What happened is more passive. In other words, it could be translated here that they appointed his grave with wicked men. Now, at the end of this phrase, you have a plural noun without an article. And so that plural noun is wicked men. Instead of with a wicked man or the wicked man, and so it can be translated, and should probably, they appointed his grave with wicked men. Generic, plural, wicked men. But, notice what it says. And the word and, you know, it can be yet, but I think it's probably more a connective with yet. And it says yet, it says, with a rich man in his grave. Now, the term rich man is singular without an article. And so, that's translated correctly. So, the idea here is, they appointed his grave with wicked men, but his grave was made with the rich man. And we know that to be true, don't we? Sure we do. The point here is that he was crucified, and normally what would happen is that they would take the three of them down and they would throw them into a common grave, and he would be buried with the other two malefactors, as King James called them. But that's what they assigned him to do, but because Joseph of Arimathea, along with Nicodemus, came and asked for the body, they put him in the sepulcher. And from there, we have the empty tomb, which is an evidence of the resurrection. Now, the resurrection could have been proved in other ways, but it was proved in this way. And so this is what we call an incidental, or it's an inorganic. It doesn't have to do anything with the fact that Jesus died, and that he died for me, and he died for you, and that he is the Savior of all men. It doesn't affect that. But it shows us the control that God had on events, didn't it? And that's exactly what it did. You know, because how can you be crucified and yet end up in a rich man's grave? Well, that's what happened. And probably, you know, gives the reason, which follows at the end of verse 9, because is better. Because he had done no violence. And the point is, he was assigned to die with wicked men and to be buried with them. But he was with a rich man in his grave. Because he hadn't done anything wrong. He had done no violence. Neither was deceit in his mouth. And then in chapter 10, verse 10, the last strophe gives to us the purpose of this servant and the work of the servant. And it's the longest one, and it culminates here, doesn't it? So what happens? Yet it pleased the Lord. I read that, and I think I can say, you know, it doesn't bother me, but it confounds me, these words. How could it please Yahweh to crush his son? And I know it did, and I know that it was because he loved the world. But I think in my mind, surely, my daughter does this. I say, surely you jest. She says, I don't jest and don't call me Shirley. No, it's, you know, sorry. Surely God could have found a different way. How could it please him to crush his son? And yet he did. And it's an evidence for his tremendous love and his work of salvation that culminates in that point in time in history, which is the central point of history, the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, it befuddles me when I think about it. I accept it, but it's hard to understand because I cannot in any way as a father understand punishing, crushing one of my daughters. Just couldn't. Well, I'm not asked to. But this was part of God's plan, and we accept it. And it's an amazing kind of love, amazing grace as well. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. Well, it was the Romans. And aside from the Romans, it was the Jews. But really, it was his father, wasn't it? They were the immediate cause. He was the final cause. He hath put him to grief. And then it says, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. And I think that's probably right. What we have here is some way to translate, when thou shalt make his soul a sin offering. And I think that's more correct, a sin offering. And what this is actually saying, and this is kind of what we did this morning, is that little part of Leviticus is fulfilled in Jesus. All of the sacrifices of Leviticus are fulfilled in Jesus. If you look at the meal offering, you look at the burnt offering, you look at the peace offering and the sin offering and the trespass offering and the heave thigh, the wave, those were all fulfilled one way or another in Jesus Christ. And he was made, and I think that the intent here, he was made a sin offering, which gives to us in kind of a nugget form that he is the fulfillment of the whole offering process that is in the Old Testament. Well, I accept that anyway, but I think it might be saying that here. Well, it says, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days. This is the Savior who's going to have a seed. Now, he had no children. He was single, unless you read the Da Vinci Code and believe that junk. No, hopefully none of you know what I'm talking about. But at any rate, you know, that was an old myth, you know, false, completely false. You know, and yet Jesus didn't have any seed literally, but he has a tremendous number of offspring spiritually, doesn't he? And you and I make up that part. But he shall see his seed. He shall see the travail of his nourishment. He shall see his seed and shall prolong his days. And the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He's going to succeed. He did. He shall see of the travail of his soul and be satisfied. Now, that satisfaction is satisfaction for what? What do you think it's for? It's satisfaction for the price and the penalty of sin, isn't it? The satisfaction, we call it propitiation today in the New Testament. But that satisfaction is satisfaction that when Jesus died on the cross, he died as a propitiatory sacrifice, which is effective for all men. Potentially effective for all men. Potentially effective for all men. That's an amazing thing. And he's satisfied. And it says, by the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many. I don't, you know, that's an interesting phrase. By the knowledge of himself, or by his own knowledge, it's hard to know exactly what is meant here. But I think what he's saying, by his knowledge of all of the workings of salvation, of the knowledge of everything that is happened upon that cross, but before and after, all of that knowledge, you know, is made up in Jesus Christ. He is that one who knows it all. And it says, by that knowledge, it says, my righteous servant shall justify many. You know, that's the kind of knowledge that I like. He shall justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Now, it says, therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. When did that happen? When did that happen? Do you know what that's referring to? I believe it's in Ephesians chapter 4, when he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. This is the picture of the spoils of war. And he has fought the fight, he has won the battle, and now he has distributed these gifts to all of his people. And that's, you can read, think about that in Ephesians chapter 4. He shall divide the spoil with the strong because he poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bare the sin of many, and makes intercession for the transgressors. He bare the sin of many, past tense, and he will make and does make intercession for the transgressors. Now, as you think about all of this package, this hymn that has all of this imagery in it, there's no way that you can justify saying this is not the Messiah. Now, the Jewish people today like to think it's Israel, and if you witness to a Jewish person and point them to Isaiah 53, which is an excellent way